This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In 1918, the U.S. Army Signal Corps sent 223 women to France to help the American communications effort during World War I. Known as the Hello Girls, the women wore uniforms, swore the Army oath, and worked complex switchboards that connected the front lines with the military command. Some worked within range of mortar fire, but despite their service, the women spent 60 years fighting for veteran status. Historian Elizabeth Cobbs is here in studio to tell their story and how it was linked to the suffrage movement of the time. And welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have you here. Well, the Doughboys couldn't keep Black Jack, as he was known, connected, and that was the reason these women went over. I call him Black Jack because actually Jack Pershing demanded, black troops. But the real need was to stay connected, and these telephone operators did the job. They were switchboard operators.
That's right. And that sounds so, I don't know, prosaic or like a simple job, but it wasn't. It was incredibly fast-paced and incredibly important. So, for example, every order in World War I to advance, to fire, to retreat, you know, to get out of the way of artillery was delivered by phone. And it took men on average 60 seconds to connect a call. It took women on average 10 seconds.
Much faster.
In wartime, that 50 seconds is your life.
And we're talking about really 150,000 calls a day that were connected, something along those lines?
That's right. 150,000 calls a day connected by 223 women. And in the course of the war, it was 26 million calls.
And the suffragette movement, which I mentioned in the introduction, was also going on at this time. I learned from your book something that kind of surprised me, because those who know their history from this period know that Woodrow Wilson was really a bigot. There's no other word that applies. But he was working on behalf of not only women, but, well, against segregation.
Well, yeah, he's this curious character, because we all, I think especially a lot of people these days, go, wow, he was a bigot. You know, he introduced segregation formally into the federal government. And yet it's also true, and this is the crazy thing about American history, he fought really for black women to get the vote. And he couldn't really say that out front, because the main reason why Southerners opposed the vote for all women was because it would enfranchise black women. And that's something I didn't know, too, until I really got going on this. So I found it just such a curious and in some ways, you know, shocking story.
It is a shocking story, particularly because of what was denied these women. I mean, let's go into that. They were soldiers, basically.
Yeah. So here's this crazy thing. You know, they serve on the front lines or near them, some of them. They serve right alongside Pershing. In fact, I found this fabulous diary from a woman from Berkeley, California. At one point, she's on the phone one morning and she's talking with Pershing, and he goes, wow. And she says, what happened, sir? And he says, wow, a shell just whizzed past my ear. Now, he's 50 yards from her. So everything that he's exposed to, she's exposed to, too. And so these women are really, you know, they're
heroic. True,
they're
Let's put it
totally heroic.
Bluntly, yeah.
They're true soldiers. And they get back and the Army says, huh?
Pensions?
Medals?
Who
are you? And two of them died over there of actually influenza, which killed more men than bullets did, at least American men. And so these women get home, and it turns out that they have to fight another 60 years to just get their veterans' medals.
And get, recognition in terms of honorable discharges, in terms of being soldiers, in terms of pensions, and all of the things that go with serving one's country.
That's right. And the oddity of it all, Michael, too, was that women at home who served with the Navy and Marines, because for the first time in world history, really, a modern country begins to recruit women into its formal armed services. So if women served at home with the Army and the Navy and Marines, they got full benefits. If they actually crossed the seas, you know, under threat of being blown out of them by submarines, if they actually served near the front lines in France with the Army did not recognize them.
If you've just joined us, our guest Elizabeth Cobbs, and I should mention she chairs American History Department at Texas A&M University and is a senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. Her book is called The Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers. This battle went up, as you suggest, to the late 70s, and the real sort of figure that looms here, at least toward the end, toward that six-decade battle, is a woman named Merle Egan. Let's talk about her.
Merle Egan. God, I just adore Merle Egan. She was the telephone operator supervisor for the Versailles Peace Conference. So this is a woman, a real standing accomplishment, a totally no-nonsense person. And when she gets back to the U.S.
Montana,
you know, a child of a union organizer. And she gets back and she sort of docilely marries the appropriate man. But then it gets under her skin that women never get this recognition. And so for the next 60 years, and I went through her papers and she writes, you know, FDR, and she writes Harry Truman, and she writes Dwight Eisenhower and John Kennedy and Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter, and pursues this through Congress all the way up to the end. And the crazy thing is that the first wave of women's suffrage, by the way, of course, has now died back. But the second wave of women's activism comes along, and she joins with the National Organization for Women and Barry Goldwater. Now, those are not two phrases that normally go together because he was a very senior conservative Republican senator. But he felt very passionately about this, too. And so together, they finally pull it out and women get recognition in 1979. As Merle Egan says, she gives this great speech. She says, "I deserve my victory medal not just for serving in France 60 years ago, but for fighting the U.S. Army for 60 years and winning."
And winning, in effect, real citizenship. I mean, that's what it amounts to, doesn't it?
It does. It's that sort of thing, like you just want to be acknowledged for being there. It's not that they were looking for money. In fact, Merle Egan says, you know, some people would say to her, "Why are you still doing this? You're 91 years old." And she said, "Because I love my country and I want my country to be worth loving. And I kept my word and my country needs to keep its word."
And other countries were way ahead of us, really. I mean, Britain certainly was, Russia even. Huh?
Yeah, so that was also the crazy thing, too. I think, you know, as Americans, our country was the first modern Republican democracy, you know, and since Columbus, basically, since the ancient Athenians.
Republican as in republic.
As in a republic, and not a monarchy, sure. Right?
Not a GOP Republican.
Correct. And those are different words, obviously. Same word applied differently. But so what happens is that the United States, actually, we're way ahead of most countries. But by the early 20th century, we're actually kind of like behind. And so 20 countries give women the vote because of World War I, largely, before the United States does. So even our enemies, you know, Austria, Germany, Bolshevik Russia, and of course, Britain and Australia and New Zealand and Sweden.
Commonwealth countries, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of these other countries. And so kind of what happens for Woodrow Wilson is he says to the U.S. Senate, he says, "Are we going to be the last to learn the lesson? How can we, you know, lead the liberal minds of the world if we ourselves are way behind everybody else?" And women have served, as he put it, upon the very skirts of the battle. And are we going to say this doesn't entitle them to be citizens?
You're also talking, and you alluded to this just a few moments ago, about the importance of recognizing that role and of giving it the kind of attention and spotlight that it deserves. And we're talking about, I mean, as you put it in your book, it's not only the home front, it's the war front, where women play a significant and an integral role.
Yes, they do. And they do in a lot of different ways. I mean, for example, there were only 223 telephone operators in France. There were many, many more American women who served as nurses. There were also British women who served as nurses and as telephone operators in all kinds of capacities. So part of what happens is, and it's interesting because it's fun in the book also to explore the women's suffrage movement. And we often look back on the women's suffrage movement and say, well, why after 70 years? You know, does this finally happen? And a lot of people go, oh, well, you know, maybe it's because Alice Paul, who was a little more radical, was more convincing than Carrie Chapman Catt. And so there's kind of a debate about that. But really what you have to look at is that, no, something else happens. 70 years is a really long time. And as one of the suffragists put it, she said, we were in a rut that was worn deeper every year. So what happens is World War I. And it's women's service in World War I that kind of connects the dots for everybody worldwide. The British do it too. Then they enfranchise women beginning in 1917. And they say, you know, what were we thinking? You know, so as a part of, for the British, as a part of giving the vote to what they call the Tommies, those were the infantry, British infantry. We called them doughboys, the American infantry. But to enfranchise the Tommies, men without property for the first time, that's what they did in 1917. And they said, well, gosh, we got to give it to the vote to women then, too.
It also certainly helped and was a major catalyst that you had these larger-than-life and really almost tireless, passionate women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. I mean, they were instrumental. And yet the irony, as you say, is you had to wait 70 years for full rights in terms of what we're talking about here. It brings up also, I just wanted to get to this, and when we'll hear from our listeners, there's a local angle to this. You had these two sisters. In fact, one enrolled underage. Let's talk about them.
Oh, yes. So San Francisco has a great role in this story, and some of my most favorite pictures are of women parading down Market Street, in which I just walked down to come here to the studio today. And the Les Breton sisters were two sisters. One had been enrolled at UC Berkeley. And
That was Louise.
That was Louise, and her younger sister, Raymond, who was 16. And now they both lied about their age. Ramon said she pretended to be 18 and Louise pretended to be 21, but she was actually 18. And the Army officer who interviewed them, because you have to understand, these women literally held state secrets in their hands. These wires that they connected, they could hear everything that was being said. So any command that a general gave was something that they not only put through, but they might have to translate for a French general. So they had to be bilingual in English and French and also incredibly quick. And so the Bretons, Les Breton sisters, they lied about their ages, and the Army officer, intelligence officer who interviewed them said, gosh, these young women seem very mature for their ages. And of course, he didn't know that they were actually 3 years younger than they had said.
Let me bring our listeners into this. We're talking with historian Elizabeth Cobbs about her book, The Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers. And I know some of you may have questions for her or comments or would just like to join our conversation. I'd like to give you an opportunity to do that now by giving you our toll-free number and inviting you to be part of the program. The toll-free number to call is 866-733-6786. And you can join us now. And again, we encourage you to do that. Becomes interactive at this point, so please feel free to let us know your thoughts or to let us know your questions. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. And there's a whole trajectory in this book about women fighting for women's rights. It still goes on. I mean, in the Me Too movement and so many other things that are still part of the world we live in. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting any questions or comments you might have there. You can do that by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this particular segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or you can go, of course, to our Facebook page, but there are many ways to be part of the program, and we do invite your participation, as I said. So when you look back on this as a historian, and when you put all this together, as you do so well in your book, what's the lessons to be learned from this whole chapter of history?
Well, I think for me, the lesson is always that, you know, we tend to think we're going to get there, right? We're going to become a just and equal society. And it's never that way. It's even in our own lives, we don't get there. It's the process. And so I think that this idea of sort of moving the marker forward a bit, right? Making a society that is more just, that is more equal. And that's what someone like Merle Egan spent her life doing. And it was a wonderful way to spend her life, to pursue justice. So, you know, that's just the way it is. And, you know, when we look back, Alexander Graham Bell, by the way, who figures in this story because it's about telephones and the invention of the telephones. And Alexander Graham Bell said to his fiance, oh, my gosh, when I was at the Philadelphia Centennial, you know, showing off my new device called a telephone, I happened to see a woman on a soapbox. Her name was Susan B. Anthony. And I was so shocked because she was speaking in public. Well, his fiance wrote back, gosh, you know, I do think women should have more rights, but it is terrible when they make a spectacle of themselves because, you know, then it damages their cause. So, you know, this is just like today where we say, you know, how can we put forward these ideas? How can we do it in ways that are respectable, that will earn people's admiration? So it's an ongoing, you know, work in progress.
Well, talk about the reaction of the doughboys. I mean, suddenly they're seeing women, you know, in the front lines, no less. How do they react generally?
Well, you know, they reacted in different ways. I mean, some of the men were, you know, annoyed, you know, what are you doing here kind of things. But listen, if somebody's firing at your head, Michael, what you care about is not the color of their skin or their gender. What you care about is that they are a person who is going to give every last bit of effort to save your life. And I think that's what really inspired a lot of the men. Pershing at one point, the women, I don't know, Pershing was going by in a car or something, and the women were standing by the side of the road, and they snapped to salute. And he saluted them back, and he said to his aide in the car, he said, you know, those women are real soldiers.
Let's talk about Pershing. I mean, quite a figure, and larger than life.
Yeah, he was. He's so interesting because, you know, some historians portray him as a kind of just, you know, central casting character, sort of stiff, uninteresting, you know, by the book man. And I'm sure that's part of who he was. But he was also Blackjack. I mean, he was a guy who grew up in Missouri. And right after the Civil War, he taught colored kids, as they were called. He needed a job after high school, and he taught in a colored school. And some young other white kids came in and said, "What are you doing here?" and tried to break up the school. And he said, "Listen, Abraham Lincoln said these people need to be educated, and that's my job." So, you know, he was an individual who, you know, took on the questions of justice of his own time, but in this sort of simple way. By the way, he has a great San Francisco connection, a tragic one. He was commander of the Presidio at San Francisco, and there was a terrible, tragic fire, and his wife and two daughters were killed in a fire at the Presidio. He never married again, although he did have a bit of an affair, and at the end of his life married a woman he had met in France.
Listener wants to know, how did you decide to look into this particular story?
So weird, Michael. Historians were always scrapping around for the latest thing. You know, I knew World War I was coming up, and actually this year, in fact, this month, is the 100th anniversary of when these women took the Army Oath. So they were right here in cities like San Francisco, but across the country.
Do you know Adam Hochschild's book about World War I?
No, I don't.
I'm going to recommend it because it's one of the best books I know on World War I. It's about all the underserved. I mean, how shall I put this? I'm not underserved. Those who really didn't get much recognition, not women necessarily, but just soldiers and people who were against the war, particularly those who were in dissent. I mean, it was a war of catastrophic stupidity in many ways.
Yes, it certainly was. I mean, it's tragic. And in fact, I always say this is not to honor World War I. This is to remember it. I mean, just to get a little tiny peek into this is to know that J.R.R. Tolkien, when he wrote about the Land of Mordor, what he was channeling was the landscapes of northern France, those landscapes that were so brutalized and so devastated that they looked like another world. By the way, J.R.R. Tolkien was a member of the Signal Corps. So like my Hello Girls, he was a Signal Corps soldier.
Well, your Hello Girls were, you know, fiercely patriotic. I mean, really quite passionate about patriotism. It reminds me in strange ways of Wilfred Owen and, you know, those young poets who went off to fight many of them became disillusioned in World War I from the UK, from Britain. But it just seemed to be a war that was unnecessary and a war that really didn't happen. It began with the, of course, assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand, but it was really an unnecessary war, unlike World War II, which seemed like a necessary war. But they were imbued with, like so many of those young British patriots, with real patriotism.
Yeah, it was such an interesting period in world history. I mean, it's a period in which empires begin to crack, you know, when democracy begins to rise, and there's just, it's epic. I mean, that was one of the interesting things about getting a chance to write about this particular war is that, you know, I think we tend to forget about it, and yet it's the beginning. It's the beginning of everything. It's the beginning of the 20th century. It's the first time we realize, for example, that technology is not always going to be our friend, that it can come back and harm us in catastrophic ways. So it's a tremendously important event to know more about.
And do you see the suffrage movement, I mean, as it began here and as it really got steam and everything, again, tied to like ERA, National Organization of Women, all the things that would follow?
Sure. You know, I think that's why you get the sort of wave effect. And people have often talked about the first wave of feminism, the second wave of feminism, third wave of feminism. And I think that it's wave-like in the sense that, you know, change comes and we roll with it and then we sort of levels out and we see where we are now. And so certainly after women got the vote, one of the big questions is, well, what are they going to use it for? And will they use it any differently from men and that kind of thing? So it took a while for changes to catch up with us. This was also true for African-Americans enfranchisement as well. I mean, it that just because people got the vote doesn't mean they suddenly walked into the halls of power.
Do you have an affinity personally with the Hello Girls? What is it?
Oh, I do, of course. You know, you can't write about any subject without getting excited about it. Well, I had actually had been an activist. This is the first time I've ever written about women's history. My specialty is U.S. foreign relations, which is why I'm writing about war. But, you know, in my own youth, I was an activist and in the second wave of feminism and had, you know, worked on a newspaper and started a newspaper in San Diego and things like that. So I actually always felt like it was important not to write about something with which I had been so closely connected, because it is, I think, truly important for historians and all scholars to reach for objectivity, to try to understand things in a way from the outside in. But in this case, it was just such a charming subject, I had to bend my rules.
Well, it worked out well for those, in fact, who will read the book and who I hope will find, as I found, so much in it. Also, recently, it was with a friend who happens to be a head of a women's studies department, and she said she hopes, I'm not asking you to do any crystal ball gazing here, and this is a rather erudite and quite an accomplished woman, she hopes that this will be the third wave now of feminism with this Me Too movement. Any thoughts from you as a historian?
Well, it might be. And if it is, then I think that in the greatest traditions of feminism, it will embrace and engage both men and women. Because as these women understood in World War I, the people who cared most about their success were men that they served alongside. So the passion for justice, that's such an American tradition, is something that I think both men and women can bring to bear. And so in that sense, the role of men will be as important as women in this next phase going forward.
It's also the sense one has in reading your book that most of these women were, I mean, in terms of establishing themselves as autonomous and having agency, were identified largely through their fathers or their husbands. I mean, just in the distinction, of course, being autonomy as individuals, as human beings.
Well, yeah. And it's one of the ways I was trying to track down this story was, none of this was here, by the way. So, in fact, a friend of mine who's a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for History said to me, you know, I don't see how you're going to be able to write this story. It seems like such a small story. Where are you even going to find records? So I went on a hunt and I tracked down an attorney in Seattle who would help these women, a man, and he's now 70, but he was 29 at the time. And I found him through Seattle Bar Association, and a friend of mine who's a great investigator found me the family of Grace Banker. Grace is one of the other two women who figures very prominently in my story. And of course, like women of that era, the names have changed. She was no longer Grace Banker. Forgetting her new name now. Grace Timby, you know, the family name changed a couple of times. And so women were defined literally by their relationships with men. So piecing together this puzzle was very interesting to try to follow the lines, follow the trail of breadcrumbs.
Challenging for your research, obviously.
Yeah, you know, that's what makes life fun.
We're talking with historian Elizabeth Cobbs. Her book is called The Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers. Danny, do we still have over there? We played it with the billboard. This is George M. Cohan, and could say something about this because it figures in your book. We'll have listeners hear it, if you could, Elizabeth.
Well, yes. Yeah. So over there was the song of World War I, and there was this idea that America will go abroad and stay, you know, until it's necessary to accomplish what we want to accomplish.
And the Yanks are coming. That was the whole anthem.
Really. And the women sent the word because communications was paramount.
And again, this is the new technology, really. This is not only Graham Bell, but this is really something that's proliferating. It's hard for people to imagine now with other cell phones just how important the telephone was, not only in terms of war, but just in terms of human life.
Yeah, you know, this was the only technology in which the United States had any edge at the time militarily. We had been a neutral nation for almost all of our history. In fact, in many ways, other than China, the world's largest neutral nation for 150 years. So at the start of World War I, we had no munitions factories. We had no cannons. We had no tanks. And in fact, as John Pershing acknowledged, we relied upon the French and British munitions efforts the entire war. So the one thing we had was this really crackerjack domestic technology, which was the telephone. And we were best at it, than better than anyone else in the world. So that technology was incredibly important. Also because, by the way, things like radio, you know, one might think, well, what about radio? But it's wireless. Isn't that handy? Yes and no. First of all, it took 3 mules to take a radio set to the field. And a man with a wire and a spindle could run wire. so it could run wire across the trenches, set things up, etc. So, and radio was Morse code at the time, so it did not carry voices. So, and it was also insecure. Anybody could take the signals out of the air. So the phone was very important for this mission, and it was women who made literally those connections.
And the difference in terms of the background of these women is also really striking. I mean, not only where they come from, different regions and so forth, but just the women themselves. But being a telephone operator was one of those, I mean, you know, along with a secretary or a nurse or teacher, maybe just the only occupations really available to women.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you, as you said, you could be a secretary, a clerk, maybe work in a factory, be a working girl, you know, in a textile mill or something like that. But this was the one of the very first occupations where women could really engage with the newest technologies. And so in that sense, they were the masters of this new technology, and they really made it work. One woman wrote that the women's hands look like hummingbirds darting over these wires, you know, interlacing lines, quickly being changed and lines being dropped and translations being given.
How much did the folks back home know about these 223 women?
Well, they were quite well-known and famous. I found newspapers all over the country that had stories about these Hello Girls. And their leader, the young woman who was 25 when she led the first contingent over, Grace Banker, who I said, as I mentioned, she was from New Jersey, from Passaic, New Jersey. And Grace Banker won the Distinguished Service Medal. So she was the first Army woman soldier to win the Distinguished Service Medal. Nurses, by the way, were a different category. So, you know, their job was to, you know, to take care of the wounds of war. The job of someone like Grace Banker was to help the Army prosecute its war and win. And she won the DSM. So she was quite well known. By the way, she won it when the United States had occupying forces, people don't probably know this, in Germany after the war. And her brother was one of the people there who was there on the parade ground to watch his sister be honored. He had suffered wounds to his lungs from gassing in World War I, and he was there. He survived to see his sister, you know, achieve this highest honor.
Were any of the women affected by the use of gas?
The women were not. Some of them, as I mentioned, were cleared near the firing lines, people like Grace Banker. Many were in Paris. Paris was actually under bombardment when the women first arrived. And in fact, at one point, the windows went out from a concussion, you know, of a artillery concussion. And the army came in and said, "You need to get out." And the women said, "We will as soon as you do."
Well, we're going to go out with Over There, as you can hear coming up here. Elizabeth, pleasure to have you. Thank you so much. Congratulations on the book. Historian Elizabeth Cubs. Her book, again, is called Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers. She chairs American History at Texas A&M. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.